I am here today talking with Dr. Meryl Silverstein from Syracuse University. Dr. Silverstein is a longstanding, I guess you would describe yourself as a family gerontologist or a social gerontologist, and has been in the field for 4 decades now, 3 decades.
Yeah, I guess depends when you start my graduate studies, but yes.
And we are delighted to have you here today to talk a little bit about your research and a little bit about kind of disentangling some of the terms that we really, the concepts that we see in family gerontology, particularly. But first off, I want to kind of just have you share a little bit about yourself, especially what do you do as a gerontologist, and really, how did you become interested in the field of aging itself? Did it find you, or did you find it? You know, that kind of question that we often hear.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you and others who are going to access the material. That's a very good question. How I got involved in gerontology or aging as a scholar started when I was in a master's of social work program. This would have been in the late 1970s, and I did field work at a community mental health center. And they were assigning students to field placements. And they said, well, nobody's working with the elderly. Do you want to give it a try? And I did. And I worked at I think they call themselves the biggest senior citizen center in the United States. This was in Brooklyn. And I found it really intriguing to work with older people in their 70s and 80s who were intellectually vibrant, politically active. These were the days of the Grey Panthers, which were a kind of a called more radical group that was advocating for the rights of older adults. There were nursing home protests against financial abuse and maltreatment of older people. Anyway, that kind of got me interested in the field of aging because it got me interested in how people got to that point in their lives and what their motivation was and what their life course patterns were. And then, if you move the clock ahead a few years, as a graduate student at Columbia University, my dissertation supervisor, Eugene Litwack, had a grant from a kind of a fledgling National Institute on Aging. They were looking to fund projects. They funded his. I was a graduate research assistant on it. And I got interested in kind of the social aspects of aging and how people negotiate their social networks, what benefits that provides for them in terms of mental health, physical health, reduced mortality. And that was kind of my first foray as a scholar into the area. And it served as kind of a bridge to my interest in families and also demography, because I was studying mortality and migration, which are kind of two staples of demographic research. And then everything kind of snowballed from there. So that kind of gives you the short answer to my kind of personal involvement as well as my scholarship involvement in the field of gerontology.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's very interesting how individuals in our field get involved and get intrigued by the study, and there's a lot of different life experience that really plays a part. Now, you've done some exceptional work in the field of family gerontology, and a lot of students will run across different terms, you know, life course type of terms that include intergenerational solidarity, intergenerational transmission. Can you explain what's the difference between intergenerational solidarity and this kind of concept of intergenerational transmission?
Well, solidarity is a term that was, I guess, popularized and expanded by Vern Bengtson, who was a mentor to me at the University of Southern California, where I was for 20 years as a faculty member in the gerontology school in the Department of Sociology. Solidarity really refers to the cohesion between generations, and it takes many forms, right? So it can take the form of emotional attachment. It can take the form of kind of physical interaction or virtual interaction with other generations. It can also refer to kind of structural issues such as how far you live away, how much exchange or caregiving or support is provided across generations. So it's very multidimensional. I can go into kind of the nuances of how we approach it, but I think it's probably best to say that really reflects the ways that generations are bound together. Transmission is more or less a concept that we use to describe how one generation influences the other. And that gets to the domain of what we call consensual solidarity, which is how much the generations are in agreement with each other, which is kind of an end product of transmission. I mean, we're all influenced by social actors in our lives. Families may be the number one source of influence because we're raised by parents or parent-like figures. And so we're kind of trained and socialized to have various views about the world and our lives. And those influences are a form of we call consensual. Not every family conforms to that, right? So there are children who deviate from their parents' beliefs and viewpoints. But in general terms, we see a fair amount of continuity across generations. And this gets to kind of a central paradox that both Vern and I explored over our careers, which is that generations may differ in terms of their political attitudes and social outlooks. And one only needs to go kind of to the baby boomers to see that how that protest generation deviated from their parents. But when we look under the surface, we still see a lot of continuity. That is, children resembling their parents in fundamental ways, which gets to sort of the much of my current work on religion and spirituality. Although we see that overall, children and grandchildren are less religious than their parents and grandparents, we still see that the most religious parents are begetting the most religious children and the least religious parents are begetting the least religious children. So even though we see these kind of population or you might call cohort changes, without getting too technical about it, we still see that there is a transmission and a resemblance across generations in many aspects of life, including religion, spirituality, but I would also include secularity. That is, secular parents are producing more secular children. And so this kind of reinforces the kind of societal pattern that we see overall. So that's in a nutshell, kind of how we might fit transmission within kind of the solidarity paradigm.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. You talked about religion and spirituality, and it's one of the areas that you've been in most recently, which is really interesting because just recently and in the last few months and year, there's been a couple polls that have come out and said, hey, belief in God is very, very low, low church attendance, especially among these younger generations. What's going on there, do you think? Who has the most influence? And you may be asked this question quite often. Is it the parents? Is it the grandparents? Or is it mom? Is it dad? Why are these types of processes in decline as we see in the news media? Or are they in decline?
Well, yes, they are in decline, at least according to some of the big national surveys that have been done over a few decades already, that when people are asked, do you have a religious affiliation or do you identify with the denomination, far fewer adults affirm that identification. The estimates now are that about a third of adults 18 and over say they have no religion. These are the nones, N-O-N-E-S, that, of course, you know about. And that has really accelerated over the last few years. So I think it's safe to say that, you know, in another few years, we're going to be up to 50% of people who have no religion. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have religious inclinations, which may be more privately expressed, or have spiritual practices which kind of border on religion or at least on transcendent type thinking. And this is a subject of a study that's currently underway. It's just about finishing in terms of data collection to try to get at sort of more of the nuances of what we call kind of non-materialist thought, you know, spirituality, belief in a higher power, belief in let's say, you know, the soul, even to things like environmentalism as a kind of replacement for religion in terms of enjoying, you know, going out for long walks in the countryside, you know, things that might seem mundane, but give spiritual meaning to people, as well as the more traditional spiritual practices of meditation and yoga and those sorts of things. So we're trying to get at many ways that people may be, let's call it replacing, I'm going to put that in quotes, replacing religion with other forms of spiritual development. So I think the simple statistics are correct, that there are more people who are less involved in institutional religions, but we might be seeing a growth or at least a stabilization of people who are practicing private forms of spirituality. And I think we'll be producing some research papers on that in the coming few months.
And this is kind of a question that kind of popped in my head. This is an extra question. do you think these individuals are aging better than the previous generation? Or do you think, are they worse off? You know, they're kind of relying more on these private kind of practices, like you said, rather than kind of having membership, formal membership in like an organizational type of religion or group.
Yeah, that's a big question. You know, can private spirituality, let's call it, replace formal religion with all the benefits that provides that we know that has to do with kind of involvement in a formal structure and finding kind of meaning in written material, the Bible and other forms of scripture and, you know, rule-based religiosity, which, as we know, gives people kind of direction and a source of meaning in their lives. And I think we have to add the social component of participating in a formal religion. That is, if people are going to services, involved in their congregations in some fashion, that produces a strong sense of within group solidarity that produces tangible benefits in terms of having support systems. I know when we moved to Syracuse from Southern California, we left a synagogue that was very highly integrated. And we had many friends from that synagogue. So if we needed childcare, we could call any of the 10 families that we were very close to, because we were in kind of a subgroup within that organization. And they were very trustworthy and very likely to respond in a positive way to requests like that. Or if someone was sick or widowed or, you know, so on, you have kind of an instant support group that is altruistically oriented that will respond. And so we lost all that in one fell swoop, right? And that, I think, I felt that as a social loss, but there's also kind of the practical loss aspect to it, which, was felt very acutely. Now you have to build that up again, you know, and you can, but it's harder to do once again, once you've had that kind of social platform. So whether people are going to age differently without religion, the answer is probably mixed again, probably in some aspects, yes, and other aspects, no. But one can't get around the fact that as aging progresses, the need for various forms of support and eventual care becomes more important. And the loss of religion as a source of that support, if that erodes, I think that can only spell less than positive outcomes or maybe more reliance on families, which are also stretched in this area. So I think, you know, we're coming at it with some pessimism, but the data have not really spoken yet. So we don't know exactly. On the other hand, I'll just be, you know, devil's advocate here. On the other hand, individuals are extremely resilient. And that is, I think, a hallmark of the human condition. And so adjustments may be made to this sort of the absence of this institutional force of religion in people's lives as they age.
Well, thank you for sharing. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. The story that's unfolding seemed to be told. Well, when you think about the totality of your career, this is a question I've been asking everyone, and the years of research you've done and the findings that you've, you know, discoveries you've made, what is that one discovery, that one finding, whether focused on the topic of religiosity, spirituality, intergenerational relationships, grandparenting, all the work you've done, what one finding or discovery has intrigued you the most? And do you think that has helped advance the field of gerontology in some way?
Well, I'll give you two. One is older than the other. I think in some of the earlier work I did with Vern Bengtson especially, it was a bit surprising how strong parent-child relationships are in adulthood. And how consistent they are. That is, we found some adult children were very close to their parents, but in a small minority, there was conflict. And those conflicts and that closeness seemed to be consistent across the lifespan. You know, so I'll give you in one example. We found that in our qualitative interviews, that there were some families that were characterized by conflict that you would have thought would be only present among adolescent children. you know, my mother controls me and she doesn't listen to me and I feel, you know, overwhelmed by her and I don't have my freedom. And, you know, so what you'd hear about from a 15-year-old child. And then you see that this woman is 65 years old and her mother is 90 years old. So the consistency with which those bonds are maintained. Now, granted, most relationships are very close. Most of them are characterized by high degree of exchange and support and care. But there are a minority that are conflicted and ambivalent in their orientation toward each other. And if you trace back in time, you'll see the seeds of that. So it's like how consistent those relationships are, I think, was a contribution, but a little bit of a surprise because you think we're capable of change, and we are, but overall, our samples show consistency over time. The other finding, I guess, would be the importance of grandparents. And this gets to sort of the issue of transmission. So what we're finding is that even when we control for parents' orientation, we see that grandparents are active transmitters of religiosity to their grandchildren. So, and much higher in, under certain conditions. So when parents are divorced, we see grandparents stepping in and becoming more influential on their grandchildren, as well as alleviating psychological stresses and burdens in their grandchildren. So they are the kind of the silent army of the family in the sense that they are willing and able to step in. But even under what you might call normal or regular conditions, grandparents kind of have to delicately, transcend this sort of boundary between their grandchildren and their parents. But their influence is acutely felt in terms of outcomes that we can observe. That is, more religious grandparents have more religious grandchildren, even controlling for the religiosity of the parents. So I don't know if that was a surprise. We certainly went in with that as a hypothesis, but the data seemed to confirm an independent influence of grandparents on grandchildren. Whether that's tacit or active, you know, is, I think, something that more research is needed to kind of uncover. Or is it genetic, right? So it could be various pathways by which grandparents are influencing their grandchildren, but the fact that they are seems to speak to their important role within the family.
Yeah, that is very interesting. Have you found that grandma or grandpa or have a stronger effect, or do they both have an equal effect, do you think?
More equal than you would think. It's interesting because some of the research shows that grandmothers are more important transmitters, and others show that grandfathers or fathers themselves are more important. So the gender breakdown depends on what you're measuring. So when we look at the transmission of what we call norms of familism, that is how important family is to the person, how important caregiving for older people might be, we see that fathers are more important. And in some ways, the importance of fathers has to do more with the wider range with which fathers are invested in their families. So mothers tend to be more active in terms of influence overall. With fathers, you get more influence and then less influence. So, you know, some fathers from divorced families cut off themselves from their children, and so they don't influence their biological children, maybe their stepchildren more, but even then, less than, I think, overall. And so fathers have more variation in the way that they approach family life. And so what we see is that the more invested fathers and grandfathers tend to have an outsized influence compared to the less involved ones. Where mothers, they're in a way more important overall. But with fathers and grandfathers, we see more of a spread. I don't know if that's a technical issue or whether that makes sense in a more intuitive way. But I think if we were to say that one is stronger than the other, we would probably have to center on grandmothers and mothers as sort of the primary socialization agents within families, with fathers kind of taking a back seat. But there's more of a fall off for fathers in terms of the disengagement that they might have in their families compared to mothers.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. From my life experience, it was always grandma or mom that made you go to services. It was dad that said, well, yeah, you got to observe this particular day, but I think I'll skip next week.
Right. I prefer to watch football or something on Sundays or whatever, right? So you'll get more disengaged fathers, at least in terms of religion. So mothers are more involved in maintaining the religious home, I think, and maintaining religious rituals within the home. That's where it's only been true in my experience.
Absolutely. Well, the final question, the million-dollar question is, and for our class, we are really focused on successful aging and really understanding this concept from many different perspectives and avenues. Based on Rowan Kahn's concept of successful aging, and there's always been kind of this ongoing debate, what is it? How do we define this concept? My question to you is, based on your perspective, how do you define successful aging, and you know, where do you agree or disagree with this whole concept that Rowan Kahn created?
Sure. Well, as you might guess, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this and both using and critiquing the successful aging paradigm. When I was editor of the Journal of Gerontology, Jack Rowe wanted to publish an article called Successful Aging 2.0. And I said, sure, that's fine, send in a manuscript. I reviewed it, but what was strikingly lacking in his update of the paradigm was what I would call inequality in the aging experience. That is, people through no kind of personal choice or set of behaviors on their part might have been born to situations that, you know, of environmental pollution, of poverty, and so on, that have influenced their life trajectories that have led to what we might call unsuccessful aging, right? If you have success, you have to have failure. And I think it's wrong to put that label on people who have not had opportunities to engage in healthful behaviors and activities. And also just the randomness of life produces difficulties for people to kind of achieve this objective standard of success in aging, or genetic conditions that, you know, may be beyond individual control. So I like to think of call it successful aging as something more akin to optimal aging. That is, you're optimizing the endowments and the resources that you have at any one point in time. I think that word, or at least that concept, might be more inclusive and more useful. I guess, you know, and here I would borrow from sociology and psychology. It's, you know, hard to come up with kind of a new concept of successful aging. But I think what resonates with me are concepts of resilience. How that's developed is a whole other story, but to have resilience in the face of adversity. You know, the term or the phrase aging is not for sissies, right? It becomes a bumpy road, and it becomes a challenging road. And your ability to adjust and adapt to changing conditions becomes, I think, very important. And I guess those two concepts of optimal aging and resilience may describe, I think, a broad range of strategies that people can think about in terms of giving their old age, you know, purpose and meaning. So perhaps the third leg of the stool on this is kind of the Ericksonian concept of generativity, right? Of remaining active and productive and engaged throughout life. And Rowan Kahn talk a lot about that in terms of, you know, social integration and so on. But I think it's a very important aspect of it is to not see old age as a time necessarily of withdrawal, although there are camps that advocate for that, but to maintain your active involvement in whatever it is, in volunteering, in family life, in leisure activities, intellectual engagement, physical engagement, to maintain as much as possible as one approaches the last stage of life. So I guess those three things: optimize what I was just talking about in terms of finding generativity, as well as being resilient or adaptive. So those to me are the three pillars of successful aging, which fit Rowan Kahn to a large degree, but other points of view as well.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And that concludes the questions for this short interview.